All right, so as Sam just pointed out, we're not in Romans anymore. I don't know if that's an allusion to the Wizard of Oz or not, but today we're going to start a study in the book of Ruth. It will be a somewhat short study, 4 chapters, I think, in 4 weeks. We'll try. So I'm going to read the first chapter of Ruth, and then we'll give a bit of introduction and try to make it through the chapter. So Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel. You need help locating it in your Bible. So I'll read Ruth chapter 1. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his 2 sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of his 2 sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her 2 sons. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the woman survived her 2 sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. Therefore she went out from the place where she was and her 2 daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her 2 daughters-in-law, "Go. Return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." So she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "Surely we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight, and should also bear sons, would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me." When she saw that she was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. Now the 2 of them went until they came to Bethlehem. And it happened when they had come to Bethlehem that all the city was excited because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" But she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi, but call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has afflicted me?" So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. I think this is a fairly familiar story. I'll just summarize briefly what happens in the rest of the book. This is spoiler, I guess they call it, but you probably know what's going to happen. They return to Bethlehem. Ruth gleans in the field of Boaz, who is a close relative of Elimelech. And in the end, Boaz agrees to marry Ruth and to preserve the line of the family. And the book closes with a genealogy, which is maybe for us a strange way to close what sounds like a beautiful little story of romance, but in fact is important to the purpose of the book. So that's as brief a summary as I can give of the book. But I thought I would answer the question before I give something more of the introduction and themes of the book, why we're going to study the book, which in this case means why I was interested in studying the book, sorry, but that's the way it goes. It is a contrast with Romans, isn't it? Romans is fairly hard going in places, and this book, on the other hand, is well known as a very beautiful story. It's very beautifully told. English literature majors, like my daughter Evelyn, would enjoy studying it. It repays close readings. If you read a commentary, you know, the commentary goes on for pages about one verse because it has all these tightly packed allusions and all these inclusios and things like that. I'll make some comments about that, but we won't spend that much time on it. But it is a very beautifully told story. And of course, it has an important purpose. One commentator compared it to such precious stones as are small in size, but of great value. And that's the way you should think of the Book of Ruth. It's small in size, but it is of great value. But actually, one reason why I thought of studying the book goes back to our study of Esther, which concluded just over a year ago. This is kind of amusing, I guess, but when I was looking online for commentaries on Esther, I noticed how many of them were bound with commentaries on Ruth. Now, I know something of publishers, and that's one reason they're bound together is that, you know, well, Ruth is too short to have a commentary published on it. They're not going to make the kind of money they want. So they get Esther and Ruth put together. That's maybe one reason. But it was it's kind of a fruitful exercise to think to yourself, no, what do those two books actually have in common? Which is why the commentators put them together, not why maybe the publishers thought of that. Well, one thing is that they're only the only two books in the Bible named after women. So that's one thing. And they have women who are arguably very important and central characters in the story. But another thing that really comes to mind as you think of both Ruth and Esther is that they're ultimately both about God's providence, God's work of providence. Now, any book of history in the Bible is ultimately about God's providence because it is really the story of God's working. But we saw in Esther that the working of God is really only implicit. God's name is not used in Esther. It's not ever said explicitly that this is the hand of the Lord doing such and so, or this came to pass because God wanted to do this, which is the sort of thing you could read in the book of Chronicles, for example, the books of Chronicles. Now, in the book of Ruth, well, God's name certainly is mentioned. We saw that pretty close to the front of the chapter, that the Lord had visited his people. But still, in the book of Ruth, there is the sense that if God is there, he's working, as it were, behind the scenes. How is it that these things are being accomplished? It seems that Ruth just wanders into the right field. Happens to be the field of Boaz. And certainly, God uses people and apparently random events to accomplish his purposes. But both in Esther and in Ruth, the point is that God works even when we don't recognize his working to accomplish important things. Now, you could say, well, there's a big difference, right? In Esther, the people of God were about to be extinguished. And Esther was used by God to intercede on behalf of the people, plus the fact that the king couldn't sleep at night. But God worked through people and circumstances to preserve them from destruction. And here in the book of Ruth, you may say, well, you know, this is a nice story. This poor lady lost her husband and sons. But is it really worth, you might say, the effort of God's providence to work here? And one lesson of the book of Ruth is, yes, it is. God cares about us in all of our circumstances. And I'll come back to that point in a minute. So the book of Ruth, one reason that attracted me to the book of Ruth is to remind us yet once again, as we saw in Esther, that God's hand of providence is working in all of our circumstances. It's easy for us to sense that we're in something like the book of Esther because we don't have God's commentary saying, this happened to you because of that. But it's therefore important to be reminded again and again that God is working out his perfect will in history. And I think it's worthwhile studying that in the book of Ruth which is, of course, a very beautiful book anyway. So anyway, those are the couple of the things I thought about in connection with the Book of Ruth. I don't expect anyone to complain. Like, everyone says, oh, Ruth, that's a really nice book. I enjoy reading that. So that's a couple of the reasons that came to my mind for studying Ruth. Okay, I'm going to do now a bit of an introduction. You may not believe it, but I actually don't like a long introduction, so I'll wait till next week to talk about some of the things like, who is the author and when was it written. The short answer is going to be we don't really know, but there are some other introductory things I'll talk about next week. But I want to talk about a couple of main themes for the Book of Ruth. Okay. The first main theme I've already hinted at, and that is the great reversal of fortunes, if you don't take fortunes in the pagan sense, the great reversal of fortunes for Ruth and Naomi, and in fact for the whole house of Elimelech. And of course, as I've already mentioned, that great reversal of fortunes wasn't merely happenstance. That was by the work of God. And for this, really to appreciate this as a theme of Ruth, you need to get beyond maybe the Western sort of sentimental sympathy for this woman. Now, we should have that kind of sympathy. Obviously, she lost her husband. She lost her son. She was in a strange land. But it's really important for us as Westerners to transport ourselves back into that society's view. And the society's view is that if you're a widow, you have basically nothing. If you're a childless widow, you have less than nothing. You're vulnerable. You have no economic resources. Ruth and Naomi, I should say, Naomi was in a foreign land. So her circumstances were dire. And there's another point which, again, it's maybe hard for us to recognize but important for redemptive history, which is that the line of Elimelech was going to be extinguished, right? He had two sons, but his sons didn't have any children. So his name was going to disappear among the people of Israel. And that's something that's extremely difficult, again, for us to understand. I think we all sense the tragedy of maybe people who want to have children are not able to. There are many people in our society who could have children but decide not to, so it's maybe harder for us to relate to. But in a sense, God rescues the line of Elimelech from oblivion. It's not in a sense. He does rescue the line of Elimelech from oblivion. It's a very remarkable thing. One commentator mentioned, to give us a sense of this, the importance of this, what Rachel said to Jacob. Remember, Jacob had two wives, Rachel and Leah. Leah had children, Rachel didn't. And Rachel says to Jacob, "Give me children or I will die." Okay. Of course, Jacob's response is, that's in God's hands and not mine. But the sense there of the urgency, partly because she had a competitor in the marriage, but it's a sense that was true throughout the history of the nation. Give me children or I die. That's the desperate straits. Those are the desperate straits from which God rescued Naomi. And of course, as I'll note in a minute, he rescued Ruth from paganism. But let's focus first on that great reversal for Naomi. But the second of the main themes is that of God's provision of a king. Okay, now you're supposed to say, huh? God's provision of a king. There wasn't anything about a king here. But I remember I mentioned or reminded you that at the end of the Book of Ruth, there's a genealogy. The genealogy concludes with David, who was the king probably about the time the book was written. As I said, there's not a lot of certainty here. In any case, the book is probably written to point us to God's provision of a king in David. Now, that in itself may not be terribly remarkable to us. It was important for them because he was the first true king, the first one really in the line of God's covenanted appointed kings. And so it would have been important in the history of redemption that David came along. But what's even more important for the grand sweep of redemptive history is that, of course, David is in the line of Christ. David is a type of Christ. David's son was also his Lord, the Lord Jesus Christ. And so the Book of Ruth points us forward to ultimately the great king to come. And there are other things in the book that point us to Jesus. There is the picture, the fact that Boaz acted as a kinsman redeemer. We'll talk about that. But of course, that makes us think of Jesus and how he redeemed us. He became our kin, in effect, by taking on our nature. And he worked to bring us redemption out of far greater straits, you might say, than Naomi was in. And in addition to that is the fact that Christ is the one who gathers in the nations. And as I've already mentioned, Ruth is kind of a first fruits of that. There was not at that time a great influx of Gentiles. How's that for an understatement? Okay, there are only here and there Gentiles mentioned who were converted to the faith of the true God. And here's one, you might say, down payment on the great ingathering that would come through the work of the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, those are the two main themes that I would mention. And let me emphasize something. I was going to make this a third theme, but let me just emphasize this in connection with both of those. And that is that we tend to separate those two. Okay, so here was this family. They couldn't have any kids, and God was merciful to them and gave them descendants. And then we have a picture of Jesus here in David and the genealogy at the end of the book. And we, especially as Westerners, tend to separate those two. But the Bible doesn't separate the two. How was it that the Redeemer came? Well, remember the promise in Genesis 3:15? It's alluded to at the end of Romans, so we saw that a couple of weeks ago. God said in his curse on the serpent that there would be a seed of the woman who would crush the head of the serpent. Or think of the Abrahamic covenant. God promised Abraham that in his seed all the nations of the earth would be blessed. What does that mean? That meant that the expectation would come, if they were faithful generation after generation and seeking to have children and raise up a godly seed, that at one point God would send the Redeemer through them. So the fact that the line of Elimelech was going to be eliminated, sorry, I'll try not to do that one again, and the fact that the woman Naomi was childless, is to us also a tragedy, because that means potentially the line of the Messiah will be cut off. Now, we saw that in Esther in a big picture, because the whole nation was going to be cut off if what's-his-name had his way. So we can hiss when we mention Haman. But here in the book of Ruth, you might say it's the same picture in miniature. The concern of Naomi to have children and to raise a godly seed by implication is fulfilled in a very striking way, so much so that she, the one who is reckoned to be her child, is in the line of David. She is an ancestress of David, and of David came the Messiah. So you see, it's a connection between the two that should help us to appreciate the book. It's not merely God's mercy to one woman, which is important enough, and it's not just that David is mentioned at the end of the book, but it's that God chooses to work in history, in this part especially of redemptive history, through families and through fulfilling the promises of God that he would be a God to us and our children after us. And God still works that way, doesn't he? I mean, that's the way that the godly seed is to be preserved in the church still, also by the gathering in of those like Ruth from outside, you might say. But still, God calls us to the same faithfulness. And the lesson of Ruth is, no matter what your calling is, you know, whether it's changing diapers or teaching your children, or whether it's going to a different place to work in your calling, that God has a hand in all of that because he's accomplishing his great purposes in the world. Okay. 20-minute introduction. Not doing so well. Any comments or questions so far? My voice to work here. Any comments? Any thoughts? Yes, Jeff.
I take it the situation was, you mentioned, for childless widows, but just some plain sonless widows. And
yeah, especially sonless widows, right. Yeah. So, you know, in the gospel account, for example, or even in the, think back to the time of Elisha, there's a special tenderness in the when the widow's son dies, because she's not going to have any support if he's dead. And daughters are good, you know, but in terms of that society especially, that was a critical thing. Good point. Okay. Well, then what I'd like to do is to look at the first chapter. I hope we get through it. And we're going to look first at the first five verses, which really give the setting for the rest of the book. The historical setting is mentioned at the very beginning of verse 1, in the days when the judges ruled. Okay, so this is a reference to what happened during the book of Judges, which immediately precedes. By the way, if a commentary on Ruth isn't bound with a commentary on Esther, it's usually bound with a commentary on Judges, okay? Which makes sense. These events took time during the time of the judges. Judges or deliverers. Mr. Carroll led a study on that book not that long ago, and you might refer back to it. It's during that time. Now, there were good things that happened because God sent deliverers, but it was a very chaotic time, too. And there were, we're reading through this in family worship in the morning, there were some very strange judges reading about Samson. You kind of wonder, don't you? But this is a time of great lack of settlement, and it's an unsettled condition for the people of God. It's the time when the judges ruled. You might note, this is one of the inclusios, that at the end of the book, who do we have? We have David. You might say the solution, God's provision for that unsettled condition that, of course, ultimately looks forward to the Messiah. In any case, the historical situation is the day when the judges ruled, and there was a famine in the land. Often famine was in connection with the hand of God against his people because of their sins. It's not said here explicitly. But in any case, we have a man of Bethlehem in Judah who finds the situation of the famine to be such that he wants to leave. Now, there's an irony there because Bethlehem means house of bread. Okay, so there's no bread in the house of bread. The cupboard is empty. And he, Elimelech, chooses to leave to go to the country of Moab. He has two sons, and they go to Moab. Okay, so a bit more background. Moab, remember, historically was a cousin, you might say, of Israel. And as it happens often with cousins, they didn't actually get along that well historically. And one of the first of the judges mentioned in the book of Judges, Eglon, actually killed the king of Moab, and it says that the people of Israel had that they subdued Moab during that time. It's possible that the book was written during that time when Moab was under the control of Israel. But in any case, Moab carries us back to Lot, who was Abraham's nephew, so that goes way back in the history of the Old Testament. And when Lot was delivered from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, he, by the instigation of his daughters, had children by them, so children by incest. And Moab is the country that came from the older of the two daughters with her father. So they go to Moab. Now, you know, going to Moab, this is not, sorry, Dan, I want to make these comparisons. It's not like going to Texas, you know, or something like that, where, okay, you're from Oklahoma, and maybe we don't like you at certain times of the football season, but you know, Moab, this was a hostile place. Okay, it wasn't a very terribly welcoming place to go, but they went there. Now, the name of the man is given here as Elimelech, means "My God is King." Okay? So there, from the start, you have, in a kind of a subtle way, the reminder that in all of our circumstances, no matter how dire they may seem, God is still King. And Elimelech goes there, and Naomi, his wife, is given there. We'll come to her name maybe at the end. And then the names of the two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. And they go there, and it says they remain there. They stay there for a while. Okay, and then the first bit of tragedy strikes. Elimelech dies. And so she stays there with her two husbands, and they actually marry women of Moab, Orpah and Ruth. And it says they stay there about 10 years. So that's 10 years after Elimelech died, presumably after the marriage also. That's what the wording seems to indicate. Now, after 10 years, if they were going to have children, they would have, at least in that culture. But they didn't. And that is really the part of the tension in the rest of the book, because it says in verse 5, both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the woman survived her two sons and her husband. Now, I mentioned before the dire condition of the widow, and here especially the sonless widow, as Jeff helped us make that distinction. There was provision in the Old Testament law for care for the widow and the orphan. There were legal restrictions. You were not supposed to take advantage of the widow and the orphan. And it is said again and again that God was the one who would care for the widow and the orphan. Now, those are good, but they also tell us something. They underline the vulnerability, right? It doesn't say particularly that God is the defender of the rich landowner, okay? I mean, rich landowners, you might say, at least they wouldn't think they would need a defender. But it's because of this difficult situation of the widow that the emphasis is given in the Old Testament. And that's given in a sort of a subtle way here. This is where the close reading comes in, where one could spend a lot of time in Ruth. In the way Naomi is referred to, Mahlon and Chilion also died, so the woman survived her two sons and her husband. So one commentator pointed out, this underlines the fact that Naomi has lost her identity. She was Naomi, now she's just the woman. Because the fact that a woman had a husband and had children and had a line after her, give me children or I die, was such a crucial part of the woman's identity, especially in that culture, that here she's lost her name in effect. She's simply referred to as the woman. Now, the story turns there from that to verses I'll read all the way, well, we'll treat all of 6 through 18 together, to Naomi's resolve to return to Bethlehem. So it says in verse 6 that she heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people. So there's the covenant name for God is the name that's used most often. I'll mention one other here as we come to it. But and that is a covenant action, you might say, of God. God visiting his people, that's God keeping his covenant and coming to them. You might think of the Exodus and God meeting with Moses. That's the picture here. God remembered, although his hand had been against his people, he remembered them. And so he visited them by giving them bread in the house of bread in particular in Bethlehem. And so she resolves to return there. So she goes out, and it's hard to know how much of this is a cultural tradition, like, you know, the following the woman out of the town. But it's a very striking scene that we're about to discuss. And let me point out one fact, which I thought was kind of interesting. And that is that 2/3 of the book of Ruth is occupied with recording conversations. Okay, there's a lot of dialogue in the book of Ruth, and we're about to get a long chunk of it. So they're on their way out of town, out of Moab. And Naomi turns to them, to her daughters-in-law, and says, don't go with me. Go back. Okay. Now, she apparently had a good relationship with them. It wasn't like, you know, we've squabbled for 10 years now and I don't want to see you anymore or something like that. She says, you've dealt very kindly with me at the end of verse 8. It's not that she doesn't like them, but she presents certain arguments to them to encourage them. In fact, she urges them to return. Okay. And what are some of the arguments? Well, before we get to that, I should point out in verse 8, she prays for the Lord to bless them, the God of Israel, the Lord, not Chemosh, the God of Moab, the Lord deal kindly with you, as you have dealt with the dead and with me. So there's a sense of real gratitude, because they could have abandoned her after her sons, their husbands, had died, but they didn't, apparently. They dealt kindly with her. And she doesn't want to part on difficult terms, but she says, go back. The Lord deal kindly with you, and the Lord grant that you may find rest in the house of her husband. So there, of course, is the fact that they too are widows now. What are they going to do? How are they going to fend for themselves? Well, go back home, where people will know you. Go back to your mother's house, and you'll find husbands there, and you'll find rest, it says. And so, you know, there's this kind of thing you think of with the Middle East. Now, she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. It was probably, you know, to Westerners an embarrassingly emotional scene. But that's the way they related to each other. And they said, no, we will return with you to your people. We're going to go back to your people, they say. Then comes Naomi's arguments. She says in verse 11, turn back, why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Okay. Now this is kind of a strange argument, you might say. You know, are you going to stick around and wait for any sons that might be in my womb to be born? Or are you going to wait until I get married and then have children? And then are you going to wait until the sons grow up? You know, maybe they're going to marry someone else. You know, surely you'd be better off to go back to Moab and have a husband there. Doesn't sound like I'm a very, you know, attractive proposition for generating more children for you. It is maybe kind of a strange argument, but that's the way, no doubt, they would have thought of the situation, and she gives them these arguments to go back. But she gives them another argument, which is kind of a striking one at the end of verse 13, which is in essence the argument that you probably don't want to be with me because God's hand is against me. And his hand might be against you, like as, you know, collateral damage or something like that. No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes, she says at the end of verse 13, that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. Now, she says even more than that later on, so I don't want to pause here to try to think through exactly why she would say something like that or why in particular she would think of God in those terms. I'll wait a bit here to come back to it. But she really urges them to go back to her own people. And again, they lift up their voices and weep, and Orpah kisses her mother-in-law in verse 14. And Orpah leaves. Orpah goes back to Moab. It says in verse 14 that Ruth clung to her. That's a good translation. It's the same word that's used in Genesis. Remember, you know, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. Well, it's the same word here. It's not like, you know, Ruth sort of stood at a distance to see whether, you know, what would happen to her or something. Ruth attached herself to her as if she's not going to let her go, as if it's a permanent bond. And then, of course, one more time, Naomi tries to dissuade, this time just Ruth. Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Okay? Return after your sister-in-law. And what follows, of course, is this beautiful and famous vow of Ruth. But before we get to that, let me just emphasize the fact that Orpah did what you would expect Orpah to do. Right? We live in a pretty mobile culture, so to cross the line, say, from Oklahoma to Texas, although it may be regrettable, as Dan would say, is, you know, it's not that big a deal. But here, these were two nations with two gods, at least Moab had a pretended god in Chemosh, with two very different cultures, and they were hostile to each other. So, you know, the idea that you would actually cross the border to go back to this foreign land, that's what it would have been for Orpah and Ruth, to these foreign gods, just because of your connection with your mother-in-law? I mean, okay, that would be asking a lot. And actually, Naomi didn't ask a lot. And it's expected, you might say, that Orpah did what she did, and she went with Naomi's blessing. The really striking thing is what Ruth does. Because Ruth goes to a land with gods she doesn't know, apparently, at least not well. She only knows Naomi. And she further goes to the possibility of real hostility, like hatred, like people couldn't stand Moabites, if you get the idea. Okay, so she's going into a very difficult situation, which makes her even more vulnerable. Not only does she not have a husband, she doesn't have a place to call her own. She's going to a place where they probably wouldn't really like her or want to be around her. It's an amazingly courageous act that Ruth does, and it's an act which is springing from faith. So when I say that she doesn't really know the gods, I should qualify that. She apparently knows enough about the God of Israel that she casts herself wholly on him. And so let's turn then to look at what Ruth says in this vow. And then I may make a comment about why Naomi said what she did to them. Or I might forget, so you could ask me. This vow of Ruth, which is in verses 16 and 17, is, of course, quite beautiful. It's been adapted to be used as marriage vows. It is, in this case, really a profession of faith, and it's done in such a way that it builds an intensity and weight as it goes along. So do not urge me to leave you or to turn back from following you, she says at the beginning. For wherever you go, I will go. So even to Bethlehem. Wherever you stay, I will stay. Ruth had been urged by Naomi to go back to find rest in the house of her husband. She says, I'll find a house with you. I'll stay with you. Now, at this point, it's not even clear that Naomi had any property to claim. There is a question of property later on, but whether she could actually make use of it is not clear. Certainly, they didn't have any source of income. So to say, I'm going to go with you and I'm going to stay with you, is just amazing. She makes that vow. But then she says, your people shall be my people. She takes on this foreign nation to be her own people. And ultimately then, she takes on the God of Israel, the true God, to be her God. And you may notice that she confirms this with an oath at the last part of verse 17. It's an oath in the name of God, the God of Israel, the Lord, Yahweh, Jehovah, not the God Chemosh of Moab. So she takes the true God, the God of Naomi, to be hers. Even though, by the way, Naomi is not so sure that's a good idea, you might say, in the sense that God's hand seemed to be against Naomi. Now, the bit about, you know, where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. I mean, what difference does it make, you know, with that? Well, I think part of the point here is the permanence of the commitment. Okay, Naomi, you know, you've had a hard life. I figure you might, like, die in a couple of years, and then I could go back, you know, to Moab. I would have fulfilled my commitments. Everyone would think I was a nice person or something like that. No. So where you die, I will die too. And there will I be buried. That, again, is something hard for us as Westerners to appreciate, but the place of burial and the manner of burial was very closely connected with your faith. And she is so placing herself as a follower of the God of Israel that she will be buried there in the promised land in the name of the true God, ultimately, of course, with the hope of the resurrection as the promises that were given in their fullest sense. And then, as I mentioned, she closes this really astounding vow by a So self-malediction is the phrase. It's a curse on herself. The Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. If I break my promise, you know, it's like hold my breath and hope to die. How does that phrase go? Anyway, you know, that sounds kind of silly, but it is an echo of something that people actually do in the Bible. And this is a very serious thing. She's saying, in effect, may God strike me down. May God condemn me if I don't fulfill my vow. If anything but death parts you and me. So it is that Ruth gives herself wholly over to following after Naomi and the God of Naomi. Now let me emphasize just one point here. I think we understand about conversion, and that's certainly what this is describing, and we understand about the importance of someone coming from another nation, because in the Old Testament, for the most part, the people of God consisted of physical descendants of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. You might think of other examples, Rahab and of Naaman, mentioned Rahab, Lord willing, next week. But, you know, except for those three, there really aren't that many examples by name of people who converted. So we may be familiar with that and the importance of it, but I think we may tend to forget the fact that when people are converted to Christ, they're actually converted to a people. That is, it isn't a Lone Ranger kind of thing. So your people shall be my people is still true when people profess faith in Christ. That's why joining a congregation of God's people is so important, because you're saying, in effect, I'm not just taking Christ as my Savior, but I'm also taking his people. God's hand may be against some of them. You know, they may be kind of hard to get along with. You know, there may be all kinds of reasons why you don't want to, but no, you don't have a choice. God's people will be your people too, because God says he will take them for his people. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that you have to physically move somewhere else. Dan will be nice, glad to know. You don't have to move to Texas. I'm not picking on Dan today, sorry. But, you know, it's not that, but it is, in essence, it is a countercultural sort of thing. Let's hope it doesn't mean you have to dress the same way or use the same lingo or something like that, but it is quite a commitment to make. Your past is important and still part of you, but you have a new association. And that's brought home in a very striking way, just in case I don't get there, at the last verse of the chapter. So, sorry, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but this is a very beautiful thought at the end of the chapter. It says, so Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess with her, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab. So if you look at the verbs carefully, the first one says Naomi returned. The second one says Ruth returned. What? Ruth wasn't from Bethlehem. Ruth didn't grow up in Judah. But in effect, he's saying Ruth found her home. Her new home is with the people of God. So she returned. She returned, you might say, to the place where she really belonged, which is among the people of God. It's a very beautiful thing, and in a sense, it's this commitment which drives the rest of the book in terms of the association of the two, and is reflected upon even by Boaz in the next chapter. His reflection on the kindness of Ruth and the fact that to Naomi and the fact that Ruth has made this commitment. Okay, so let me try. I'm going to run over, but let me try to make comments then on the last part here, verses, we'll go 19 through 22, the concluding part of the chapter. So the two of them go to Bethlehem. And as they come into Bethlehem, the women especially are there. This does not mean the women are sitting around doing nothing, but that was, you know, they probably were working in the vicinity or caring for family. In any case, they were the ones who saw them come, and they said, is this Naomi? Now, I have to admit that when I had read this before and thought about it, I thought they meant, wow, she's a wreck. Really? That's Naomi? Boy, what has she been through? Sorry, no, I don't want to insult anyone, but that's the way I had understood it. Apparently, that's the way some people understand it, also, not just me, and some commentators. But the emphasis rather seems to be on the word Naomi, and it's a cry of joyous surprise. Naomi's back. Isn't that wonderful? Naomi's been away so long. Could it really be that Naomi has now come back? That's the way the emphasis falls on the question. It's excitement and joy because she has come back. And that's the contrast in verse 20 where, well, I don't know if it's, you know, I'm a wreck, she's exactly saying, but she makes a point of what her name means. So Naomi means to be pleasant, or to be lovely. That's her name, of course. But she says, don't call me that anymore. Call me Mara, which means bitter. So you may remember in the account of the Exodus from Egypt, there was one place where the waters were bitter and they complained to God. That's the same idea. One translator, Moffat, takes up the pun in this way. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has cruelly marred me. Okay, so there's a play on words here. I'm bitter. I have been embittered, you might say, or I have been cruelly treated. And here again comes this testimony about God. The Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. There's another name for God, the other name that's often used in the book. It's Shaddai, the Almighty. The emphasis there is on the powerful one, or God's power. And she says, God has dealt very bitterly with me. And then in verse 21, I went out full. Well, she had a husband and then two sons. But when she came back, the Lord brought her back empty-handed, we might say. And it's the Lord who did it there. And then maybe the strongest indictment is in verse 21 in the middle, or the last part. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me? So the image is that Naomi was on trial. Okay, and who is the witness against her? God. God testified against her. And the application is she was condemned and punished because of it. So she says, the Almighty has afflicted me. Now, I mentioned before that that same sort of complaint, which is a good word for it, comes up in verse 13, or lament. The hand of the Lord has gone out against me, she said earlier, to dissuade her daughters-in-law from going with her. You know, we might say, well, she shouldn't say things like that. And I guess my point at this stage is not to say whether she should say things like that or not, but to point out that no one who believes in blind fate would say something like that. In other words, Naomi is showing her faith in God when she says this. Naomi believes there is a God who is behind all of the things that happen. Naomi has undergone extremely difficult circumstances. Okay? So that's something important to consider. And her reaction to it is to say, if I've gone through these things, and if God is sovereign, it must be because God has acted. This is a very important thing to keep in mind when you read the Psalms and when we sing the Psalms. The Psalms have got lots of laments like this. And we sometimes wonder whether the psalmist really has faith if he says things like that. But someone who didn't have any faith wouldn't bother, right? He might be like the atheist who shakes his hand at the lightning strike and says, "You missed me," which apparently Madeline Murray O'Hare did once, maybe apocryphal story. But even that is a confession that there is a God who is acting in history. And so I don't really want to register a judgment on what Naomi says here, but I want to remind us that if we are in affliction, the place to turn is to God and to confess to God and to sing the psalms that God has given us to help us through times like that. Let me just conclude and note that the writer not only wraps up the chapter, so again, beautiful literary style here, so they left from Bethlehem when it was no house of bread, and they came to Bethlehem here at the beginning of the barley harvest. So God has provided for his people. So that the chapter is nicely tied off with that comment. And it also makes us wonder, well, what's going to happen in the barley harvest? So I have to come back next week to find out. But it is there, you might say, the first inkling of the fact that although God's hand really was, you might say, against Naomi, it was a difficult circumstance she went through. Yet there is hope, because God has already visited his people, and as we know from the end of the book, God will visit her and bless her in a way beyond what she really could have hoped for. Any comments or questions there? Yes, I wasn't sure if you... Okay.
I was.
Okay.
I was wondering if you would care to comment on the spiritual discernment that Elimelech showed in leaving the land of Judah to go into Moab, and then also Naomi's urging the daughters to stay
in Moab.
Right. Okay.
Moab, and
yeah.
Various things.
Right.
And
when you read
the applied to spiritual discernment, so he leaves the land of Stillwater to go to Nebraska.
Talking about me.
Okay. The moderator rules that as an illegal comment from Mr. Spittler. Unnecessarily provocative. Although there is corn in the land of Nebraska. So. And a job. Yeah. So the commentators differ on this point. Let me make a sort of a general comment, which, sorry, I'll go back to what I said when we looked at Esther. There is something of a temptation to ask questions about the book, or questions of the book, that it's not really intending to answer for us. That's I mentioned that with Esther, especially. Is Esther really supposed to be a candidate for, you know, the king's harem? Doesn't sound like, you know, I wouldn't put my daughter there, but, you know. So the book doesn't maybe necessarily invite us to ask those questions. Here, I would hesitate a bit in terms of the way Elimelech acted. It was certainly true that it was the promised land, and we might say that the person who has faith would stay there. I tend to lean in that direction, and the older commentators, like the Jewish commentators, you know, say that's why the sons died, that's why he died. But on the other hand, some commentators point out that the patriarchs all went elsewhere when there was a famine, and Elisha, 2 Kings 8, sorry, I put down 1 Kings 8, that must be 2 Kings 8. 2 Kings 8, Elisha counseled a woman to go elsewhere in a time of a famine. Now, she was in the northern kingdom, but maybe the northern kingdom is similar to the way it was during the period of the judges. So I would say, you know, it's hard from this distance to say. In general, I think the command was to live in the promised land because God promised to bless them there. If he sent a famine, then you should go through it. But you can make the argument the other way. Sorry, not answering your question, really. In terms of Naomi and why she said those things, okay, so you can find commentators both ways. I actually found, in this one, I found Matthew Henry quite persuasive. Matthew Henry says she's really testing the faith of these two women. And there are examples of that. Jesus, for example, you know, he referred to this woman and her kin as dogs. But in the end, he blessed her. And that's something like probably what Naomi is doing here, I'm convinced by what Matthew Henry says. She's trying to make them count the cost. You know, if you go back with me, it's not going to be a bed of roses. It's going to be a difficult circumstance. So she's saying, in effect, that I want you to think through what you're going to do. I think that's a helpful way to understand it. You know, the other extreme is that really, if you don't believe that, then you're saying she doesn't want to see them converted to the God of Israel, because she's really shutting off their only possibility of hearing further of the gospel. So that's possible, but it doesn't really sound consistent with the Naomi we see later on in the book. But I could, you know, I could entertain arguments the other way. But that seemed to me to make sense, that she was trying to do that. Yeah, I guess the argument could be that she's like Jonah. Sorry, Jonah. Like the Jonah and the whale. You know, I'll preach in Nineveh, but I really don't want these people to be converted. You know, you could argue that she has that kind of attitude, perhaps. Having said that, though, I don't think any of us would really go to that extent to try to dissuade someone from falling. You know, count the cost before you come to Christ. You don't want to be like me because God's hand is against me, so you don't want to be a Christian. You know, that doesn't sound like exactly the way we would do it. So it's kind of a difficult point. But I think it really is important for us to keep in mind the main point of the story, which is the great reversal of fortunes for Naomi and, of course, for Ruth also, which comes, you might say, despite what her husband had done and despite what she did. That's an even greater magnification of the grace of God. Other comments or questions? I must be running over. Okay. Let's close in prayer.